Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Damian McEnany, a permaculture practitioner and arborist from Sonoma County, California. During our conversation, we discuss his background and biography, as always, and then proceed into trees and tree trimming. Along the way, we discuss different tree care techniques, such as natural target pruning, as well as tools for your toolbox, before wrapping up by talking about a group he started, the Sonoma County Permaculture Professionals, which is an organization to help support people who are practicing permaculture professionally. If you're interested in going down this road in your own life, this is definitely worth a listen. If you're not necessarily looking at permaculture from a professional perspective, there's still a lot you can learn on caring and managing for your trees. If you enjoy this or any other episode of the show, please consider helping make it grow with a donation. Find out how at thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. I'll join you after this interview with some thoughts and a much longer than usual update. Please stick around for that, as I'm looking for your feedback on some things. Now then, on to Damian McEnany.
If you're ready, Damian, could you give us some of your background and biography and how you came to the work that you're doing?
Yeah, definitely. So I originally came to permaculture just sort of from reading and my social connections, learned about it. And I got laid off at one point from a job. We lost grant funding. And I made the decision that I wanted to learn permaculture and get paid to learn it. And I told everybody that I knew about that. And everybody said, oh, you should work for Eric Olson. So I ended up contacting him. And over a period of time, he ended up hiring me. And I worked on his permaculture landscaping crew and worked for him for a couple of years. And worked on some really, really amazing permaculture projects with Eric. During that time, I also took a permaculture design certification course with Eric, which was sort of a great dovetail with the practical work I was doing. And then as time went on, through a series of events, I decided to become a certified arborist. And for those who are interested, how shall I say this? As some permaculturists are saying, it's really important to have an area of expertise within permaculture. There are so many possible areas that you can work on in being a permaculturist. It's really important to have some focus. So I decided that my focus was going to be trees. And there is an International Society of Arboriculture who certifies arborists. And so I took the test to do that. It was challenging, but not overly challenging. And since then, that's really been my focus, has been arboriculture within the context of permaculture and really taking care of trees in permaculture design systems. So let's see, later that would be 2009. In 2010, I really wanted to sort of get outside of this circle I was in Sonoma County, and I decided to volunteer at Jeff Lawton's Jordan Valley Permaculture Project in Jordan. And I raised some money and went there in January of 2010. And donated some money to the project and worked there for a period of time. And that was really fascinating to see permaculture in a different context in Jordan, in a Muslim country, and to see how they operated that particular project. When I came back from Jordan, we were actually having a shortage of work at Eric's, and Eric encouraged me to start my own business at that time. So I started my own business, which is Abundant Earth Landscaping and Tree Care. And I was totally new, and I know, Scott, you can relate to this, and just didn't know even what I didn't know in terms of running a business. And so that was really challenging. And in that process, I realized that I needed quite a bit more support. And so eventually, that led me to start something called the Sonoma County Permaculture Professionals, which I'll talk about more later in depth. But it was really a place where I could get support for running my business, help other people get the support that they needed, and really raise the bar of professionalism for permaculture in Sonoma County as a whole. Let's see, a couple other pieces on that story. I took a permaculture teacher's training somewhere along the way there with Kat Steele and Ben Farrar, and that was a fantastic experience. And then just last year, I started working for another permaculture company, Equinox Landscape, as their maintenance manager, doing ecological and permaculture maintenance, and being their certified arborist on staff. And I really wanted to take my design work to another level, and so this last year I took some landscape design classes at the junior college, and that has been incredibly helpful for me. Because in the permaculture world, it doesn't tend to be a lot of specific training on how to do sort of the technical landscaping aspects of design work. So that's been a part of my professional development. And I think that's probably all the major points in terms of getting me to where I am at this point.
You also speak to many of the things that are important from my perspective of coming through this process, of finding that niche, of getting the additional training, of finding out where you fit, how you fit, and then also, you know, making it all work between having your own landscape company, but also finding some other work where you still get to specialize within your own niche.
Yeah, I really think that's critical. People coming into permaculture often don't have a sense of what their thing is, and that's okay in the beginning, but I think eventually you really need to find your specialization and really sort of sink into that, and then to find collaborators who can maybe do the other stuff that you don't do as well. In that way, it can really be an ecosystem of permaculturists working together and going a lot further than people could on their own.
I find that that also removes many of the barriers of competition as you're supporting and working with one another.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, because then you can really collaborate much more freely, and it's not this sort of head-to-head, oh, well, we're doing exactly the same thing, and if you get the contract, then I don't get the contract.
And I find that coming out of the permaculture design classes, at least in the last few years until I've started connecting with a lot of other people, and I'm sure other folks have this experience as well, it seems like the only options are to teach permaculture or to go and start your own kind of landscape company and try to make it work.
Those definitely tend to be the major options. And I think you, Scott, are showing an amazing example of another option, which is provide public education around permaculture. And also, I think there's a lot of subspecialties that people can go into. So, you know, I'm doing arboriculture, so that's sort of my obvious one. But a lot of the natural building stuff and a lot of microenergy, you know, production is very permaculturally oriented and it's easy to integrate, I think, into a lot of other areas. And I think even within landscaping, even people who are specifically landscape contractors, I think there's a lot of room for collaboration where, let's say, somebody knows a lot about key line design and pond building, and somebody else happens to know about, you know, high-end, you know, residential landscape design, that they can really work together on projects and do what they do best and maybe do what they are most excited to do.
And we can take that even like one further step out from that ring and look at the lawyers who can help people to change the laws in the local community to allow for some of these systems. Like, I know we have issues with keeping chickens in non-rural spaces or gray water systems, all these other things that we can continue to make those connections. I'm still waiting for someone with an MBA to come along and say, I want to take this information and apply permaculture to standard business practices.
I know somebody along those lines. There's a couple guys in San Francisco who did sort of standard permaculture design and teaching for a number of years and eventually felt that they needed a switch. And so now they are business coaches. They're a team and they coach permaculture businesses, but a lot of other, you know, small cooperative businesses and things along those lines. And they're applying these principles to running businesses.
And I think we can touch on that a bit more as we talk about your Sonoma County Professional Permaculture Group. But I'd like to, before we go too far down this road, I'd like to look at how your specialization working with trees has impacted the work that you're doing with permaculture.
So I love trees. I mean, a lot of people love trees. But I decided to make trees my profession in a lot of ways. And so, because permaculture is so broad, a lot of times when people go into doing permaculture designs, they don't necessarily have a lot of specialized knowledge in trees. Interestingly enough, a lot of landscape architects don't have a lot of specialized knowledge about trees either. And so it's not just sort of the permaculture landscapers. It's a lot of people who are doing very professional, upscale landscape designs that don't have sort of an in-depth knowledge about how to plant and take care of trees. So where do I see that coming out in design work? One of the areas is that people really forget about tree roots. Because they're underground, we're like, oh, well, they can't be all that important, right? It's sort of an afterthought. And one of the things that really commonly happens in landscape projects is people are laying irrigation lines, and they'll trench right through tree roots. And not really think much about it. They're like, oh, well, it'll be fine. And they get out their sawzall and hack up the roots. And afterwards, they're like, oh, the tree looks fine. Obviously, it's not injured. And a lot of times, it can take several years after cutting big roots like that to watch the tree sort of go into a slow spiral of decline and eventually die. So one of my sort of hallmarks is really taking care of the roots. Another thing that can happen with permaculture designs in terms of implementing them is we tend to do a lot of grade changes because you'll do rainwater harvesting systems, so rain gardens, swales, what have you. And again, people don't realize that either cutting into the roots is really damaging for them or else dumping soil on top. Like, well, how could that hurt? They're just roots. They'll just grow up. But if you put more than, say, 6 inches of soil on top of the root, they can have a much more difficult time getting the oxygen that they need. And you can have a lot of root die-off in the long run from raising grade around trees, especially older trees. Older trees have a harder time adjusting to those sorts of changes than younger trees do. Let's see, what else? Pruning? There's a certain ideal. I don't know how much the listeners in general know about Sepp Holzer. Sepp Holzer is an unquestionably outstanding permaculturist, and I think he doesn't do a lot of pruning at all on his trees. And he has a certain mastery in terms of doing that. I think most of the rest of us, you know, the truth is I think a lot of trees respond quite well to human-scale pruning, and especially fruit trees is a very specialized type of pruning. So since people are planting fruit trees all over the place for permaculture projects, it's really a niche for me to be able to come in and to prune a tree well so that it reduces the amount of diseases that it's going to have, and it really produces a lot of fruit. And properly pruned trees tend to produce a lot more fruit than trees that are not properly pruned. So the piece is really sort of understanding water and thinking through consequences on trees. Around here in California, so I should say I'm about an hour north of San Francisco, we have an annual drought. We pretty much get zero rain for 4 to 5 months. So maybe late May, middle May, through about the end of September, we get no rain whatsoever. And so it's really important to pick trees that are going to be appropriate for either that climate or the irrigation regime that they have. There was a recent situation I came across where a group was sheet mulching a lawn, which is great, to get rid of the lawn and plant either more food or more drought-tolerant plants. And somebody asked me, you know, there's a redwood right next to the lawn. Is it going to be an issue that we're sheet mulching and turning off the irrigation? And it's interesting, although redwoods are native to Sonoma County, they're native to the coast, where literally they can get 90 inches of rain a year. And inland, where I live, we get more like 25 inches of rain a year. And so I said, you know, if you sheet mulch that lawn and you turn off the irrigation, you're going to have some very serious problems with the redwoods. So you need to make a plan that those redwoods get the water that they need, unless you're going to decide to remove them and put something else in their place.
Your concentration on thinking about the roots and the impact that that has on a tree. I recently spoke with Robert Couric, and he mentioned that one of the things that we don't think about that often are the roots because they extend so much further out from the canopy than we would normally expect. That a lot of times the idealized like drawing of a tree is that the canopy and the lateral root structure are kind of equal.
Whereas in truth, they tend to extend well beyond the drip line, sort of the edge of the canopy space. Most of the things I've learned about roots I've learned from Robert Couric. He's a really great author and researcher. And yeah, it's really true. The roots extend way out, and so you have to be careful. That doesn't mean you can't ever cut the roots. There's a time and a place to cut roots, just like there's a time and a place to cut the branches. But yeah, we don't tend to think about that, and we tend to think that roots go really deep. I hear a lot of people talk about redwoods, and they say, oh, well, you know, redwoods are so tall, but actually, the roots are very shallow. Well, the truth is, most trees have pretty shallow roots. The majority of their roots are in the top, say, 3 feet, and even 1 foot, you probably have the greatest mass of roots. And we really got to take care of them, and it's trickier because you can't see them and you don't know where they are. Oh, I'll mention one tool because I think this will be interesting for your listeners. There is a relatively new tool out there. It's called an air spade, and it hooks up to an air compressor. You soak down the soil underneath the tree, and then you use this tool to literally blow away the soil. It'll also damage the smallest roots, but it won't damage anything of really any consequence. And so one thing you can do is use an air spade and strip away the soil and see where your major roots are, and you can design or landscape accordingly to avoid cutting those major roots. And it's really a fantastic tool. and it enables us to deal with trees in a way that we can actually see the roots and go around them without hurting them.
When you mentioned that there's a time and a place for cutting roots or pruning branches, here in Pennsylvania, one of the common rules of thumb, if you will, is that the time to trim branches is any month with an R in it. And for the temperate climate, that seems to be more or less true. How does it apply in California and the area that you're in for when you do your pruning? And I'd like to hear more also about cutting tree roots. That's something I haven't had a conversation with anyone about.
Okay, so in terms of time for pruning, out here in California, I have a friend who's a master arborist who says, you know, you can really cut trees here any time of the year. But I would say that it's better to cut trees in certain times than others. For sort of a quick rule of thumb, and realizing that rules of thumb always have exceptions, I tend to say it's less stressful on the trees to prune them in the winter, even maybe late winter, if you are really working with a healthy tree. You're trying to make the tree bigger and more robust, especially fruit trees. For the most part, fruit trees, we prune them during the winter, and then they get a big flush of growth in the spring, and that's what we want, and that's really good and healthy for them. In the summer is actually a good time to prune healthy trees that we want to keep smaller. So there's all sorts of reasons that people want to have trees smaller than they are. And generally, it's better to pick trees that are going to be small to start with, but some people buy houses, and they can't help it. You know, the tree is the size that it is. And so summer, when you prune a tree in summer, you basically reduce some of the energy stores for the tree, and that keeps it from bouncing back the following year. So you don't have as much of a growth spurt in the following year if you prune in the summer. You got to be careful with that. If you have a tree that's not particularly healthy, then it's really better to prune in the winter because the tree retains all of its energy stores, which it needs to, you know, fight disease or fight, you know, rot if it has some rot issues. That being said, if you have dead or diseased branches, the best time to prune it is immediately. There's no harm in taking off dead stuff. It's really good for the trees. And if you have diseases, you want to prune it as soon as you can so that there's less chance that disease will spread to another part of the tree or to a different tree. You can also prune in the spring and the fall, but I tend away from that. That's sort of when the sap is flowing more up and down in the tree. And it's okay, but I would say it's less desirable.
Now, when you're pruning, I've been told to look for the branching, the branching collar off of a branch if I want to cut, and to make the cut just in front of that?
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up. Some people call it natural target pruning, and that's one of the two absolute basic rules that I tell people when they're pruning. I really believe in principles, and there are principles to pruning just like there's principles in permaculture. So the idea when you're pruning off a branch is that you want that wound to heal as quickly as possible. Because if the wound stays open, then there's a chance that rot is going to get into the stem and cause problems. So many trees have an obvious branch bark collar that sort of sticks out. It's a little bit fatter than the branch. Most trees have a branch bark ridge, which separates the main trunk from the branch that's sticking off. You always want to leave the ridge intact. That's really crucial. And as much as possible, you want to cut just outside of the collar. And sometimes you can't see the collar. And so in that case, the way I try to describe it to people is you're trying to leave the ridge in place, that sort of ridge bark, and you want to make the wound as small as possible. If you think about it, generally the smallest wound is going to come from cutting perpendicular to the direction that the branch is going in, at a 90-degree angle to the direction the branch is going in. So that makes more of a circular cut, assuming that the branch is circular, rather than cutting at a different angle, which makes more of an oval cut, where you get a larger wound. The other principle that I really like to teach people about that's really pretty simple once you understand it is that when you're pruning a branch, and there are exceptions, there's always exceptions, when you're pruning a branch, either you want to remove it completely, so down to where it attaches to the trunk or to a larger branch, or if you're making the branch smaller, you want to cut it back to a side branch that is at least one-third the diameter of the branch that you're cutting. The basic idea is you want to cut back to something relatively big because that's going to have enough sap flow to heal the wound more quickly and also to take over the additional growth of the part that you're cutting off. And if you don't do that, what you get is you get a whole bunch of sprouts that come out. Those sprouts tend to be more weakly attached, and so they don't form good branch connections in the long run. And we call that the rule of thirds. I know this, it's a little confusing in art and photography. There's a rule of thirds as well, but it sort of helps people remember it.
This is our rule of third for pruning.
Yeah. Natural target pruning is sort of how you make that final cut there, and rule of thirds is what you use in terms of reducing the branch. I'll also just say very briefly, for people who aren't aware, who are really pretty new to pruning, we talk about using three cuts to make a prune for a large branch. So if you're cutting something that's larger than you can comfortably hold with one hand, we finish that prune in three cuts. So first you go out on the branch just a little bit, maybe 6 inches. You cut up. You're cutting about a third of the way up on the branch. Then you go out another couple of inches. You cut down. You cut completely through. So you're cutting off the majority of the branch. And the reason you do that is you don't want a large branch to tear bark down the trunk. Because when that happens, you have a larger exposed wound. It takes longer to heal. There's more chance for infection. So after those two cuts, you have a little stub left. And then finally, you'll do the natural target pruning with that little stub. It's really easy and manageable, and you can get it in exactly the right place. So it sort of takes the stress off the branch and ends up getting a better pruning cut in the end.
I can say that I made the mistake when I was first learning about pruning not to do those three cuts when cutting off a side branch, and I wound up stripping a large section of a longer branch and wound up having to go back and remove more to do it cleanly.
Yeah. And a lot of times, you know, just going too quickly, we'll end up doing that. We're not paying attention. So it's really important to do that with any branch that you can't sort of reasonably hold in your hand and support. It's all about taking care of trees because we want our trees to be as healthy as possible because they take care of us.
When you're pruning, are you using hand tools, chainsaws, or just whatever you need to do to get the job done?
Yeah, it's whatever I need to do to get the job done. To be honest, I really don't like chainsaws. They're efficient, they're fast and whatnot, but they end up sucking a lot of gas fumes, and they're very temperamental and sort of tricky to get just right. And also, let me say, for those permaculturists out there who are using chainsaws, please learn how to use them properly. Please use proper protective equipment. And especially if you're climbing in trees, really get some professional training if you're using a chainsaw, because chainsaws are really dangerous, and a lot of people get injured and die. I heard this story about a friend of mine is from England, and there was a hurricane in England, and all these trees fell down, and very few or no people were injured in the actual storm event. And then people went to clean up all of the felled trees, and 10 people died from using the chainsaws. And so they changed the chainsaw laws in Britain that essentially you need a license to operate a chainsaw. I'm not advocating for that here, but I advocate respect for chainsaws because they are quite dangerous. Whenever possible, I prefer using hand saws or pruners, obviously, if it's just sort of little twigs or whatnot. Getting a good hand saw, they can be pricey. You can make as much as sort of $80, but they're just a dream to use a good hand saw. They cut so clean and quickly and beautifully.
I finally took the time to invest in some quality hand saws. I got some of the Japanese-style pool saws with a replaceable blade so I didn't have to worry about sharpening them, and found it to be pretty reasonable, and then a replacement set of blades was very inexpensive, and I can toss the blades in my recycling bin.
I'll put in sort of a shameless commercial plug. Silky, I really love Silky hand saws and pool saws. It costs a bit more than some of the other companies, but I just find that there's really outstanding quality with those blades.
If that's the company I think of, they have a two-handed pool saw with a 20-some-inch blade that I've been looking at. And they call it like a manual chainsaw because the cutting power is just incredible.
Yeah, the cutting power is pretty amazing. And once you get to a certain point in branch size, you just have to use a chainsaw. It gets impractical at a certain point.
I can't imagine going to something like a two-man, a 6-foot saw to cut down a tree, at least at the moment.
In the long run, if predictions of peak oil are accurate, we will be going back to hand saws to do stuff like that. And, you know, if you have really good blades and there's a good setup and whatnot, you can make pretty quick work of it. But there's definitely a place for chainsaws at some point in our box of tools.
And like everything within the world of permaculture, it all depends on where you are and what you need to do, what tool you use at that time.
Yeah, and I'll also say, you know, chainsaws are pretty expensive tools, and so people starting out can't necessarily afford to get themselves a $400 chainsaw.
And that's, I think, one of the things about many of the tools that we add as permaculture practitioners, whether it's books for our library or actual hand tools or power tools that we're going to use in the field, is that they are ultimately an investment. So if you want to buy that $400 chainsaw, how does that change what else you might be investing in that you might be able to afford earlier to get the work done that will be a tool that you can have for many years that's a hand tool, rather than maybe trying to split that gap and buy a lesser quality handsaw and a lesser quality chainsaw?
Yeah, absolutely. And you have to have a sense of whether are you most likely to wear out this tool, break this tool, or have this tool lost or stolen, and sort of make your buying decisions based on some of those guesses, you know, in the long term. And if you think that generally you're going to be, you know, taking care of the tool and you're going to be using it well and it's going to be, you know, safe from theft, yeah, then really invest in some good quality tools, because it takes a huge amount of resources to make those tools. And so if you get the high quality stuff, it's easier on the earth. And reasonably, it's easier on your pocketbook in the long run.
That thought of investing in tools, and you mentioned, you know, if something would get stolen, makes me think about practicing permaculture as a professional. Because you and I, as business owners, we have access to different insurance and different things that we can write off as a business owner within the structures that we have. You know, if a tool gets stolen, we might be able to account that as a loss, or we may have business insurance that would cover that loss at a lower deductible than maybe a homeowner who might have a $1,000 deductible on their homeowner's insurance, so their chainsaw being stolen wouldn't be covered. Moving into the thought of professional permaculture, could we talk about what it's like for you practicing as a professional, some of the barriers that you've run into?
Yeah, I'll talk about both about my personal experience and about the Sonoma County permaculture professionals. So when I started my own business, I had no idea which end was up in terms of starting a business, and it was incredibly challenging. I don't think there's a lot of people who are natural business, you know, leaders. There's a few people who are, but generally we got to learn these skills. And so I'll tell you this really, I think, is a funny story. I went into our local sort of garden supply store, really fantastic store called Harmony Farm Supply, to get a professional account there. Just sort of keep track of my records, get a discount, things like that. And there was this form I was supposed to fill out, and I was supposed to check the boxes, am I a sole proprietor or a limited liability corporation or a regular corporation? And I didn't even know. I made the right guess in the long run, but, you know, I didn't even know what I didn't know when I started out. And that was really challenging, and that had sort of an economic effect in terms of running my business, because there were so many things that I didn't know how to do. So over time, I realized, wow, I really need a lot of support in order to run my business well. And there's also the people who know this stuff. It seems silly for me to keep recreating the wheel. So I created a group called the Sonoma County Permaculture Professionals, and it takes the place of what is a permaculture guild in a lot of other areas. We used to have a permaculture guild in Sonoma County, but we weren't able to maintain it, to get enough people interested in putting in time to make it continue. So I decided to start this group specifically for people who are doing permaculture-related work for money. And that reduced the pool a little bit of people who would be involved, but my hope was that it would be a place that we could actually discuss business ideas. Because there's a lot of places around here where people can learn permaculture skills and take classes. But for permaculturists, as permaculturists, to talk about how to do books and how to get workers' comp insurance and how to do advertising and who to go to for legal advice, there really wasn't a spot for that. So at a minimum, what I found was, starting out a business, I was mostly working by myself, and I just loved having the camaraderie of coming together with these other business owners and talking about our businesses and just having that sense of support that, oh, we're in the same boat. We're going through these similar struggles. You know, what did you do in this particular situation? So I really appreciated having that community and really in creating that community. Another thing that was crucial for me, both in my own business and for the community as a whole, was to raise the bar of professionalism for permaculture in Sonoma County. And I don't remember whether you've had this specific conversation with other people on the show, but I've had the observation that there's a lot of permaculturists, both locally and nationally and internationally, who don't necessarily operate in a very professional manner. And what I mean by that is either they'll do things that are beyond their training or experience and have significant problems with it, or, you know, just won't follow through in terms of billing or in terms of getting back to somebody, you know, the project they're working on or whatnot. And my concern was that that really affects what people think of as permaculture locally and in the world. And that I know there are people out there who, when they think of the word permaculture, they think, oh, it's a bunch of flaky hippies. And there's some basis for that stereotype. And I really wanted to change that because permaculture is so important to me that I want it to be more popular and used more generally in the world as a whole. And I realize that in order for that to happen, we've got to up our game and we've got to really be professional and competent and dependable, people that the general public can really trust with their money and with their projects.
I had part of that conversation when I interviewed Eric Olson about practicing professionally. I've also, though, while we're having this conversation, the interviews haven't been out yet. You haven't gotten a chance to hear them. I also, when I interviewed Dave Jackie and Larry Santoyo and, well, Robert Cork as well, that was part of the conversation that we had was the ability to be a professional. The way that Dave put it was to be impeccable with your word. And for me, part of my professionalism is to be transparent, to be open and honest about things. Dave borrowed the line from 1984 that vulnerability is strength. You know, we have to put ourselves out there for people to know who we are in order to really start to move forward. And it's some of the other conversations I've had that deal with the criticisms of permaculture is that some of these, as you say, people think of it as like flaky hippies or whatever. I've had people come to me and have conversations about permaculture on both sides of the extreme, that it wasn't the middle of the road. And, you know, how can we use this to approach people who are in business? For me, it's being able to shave off my beard, take out my earrings, put on my long sleeves to cover my tattoos, and go in there and look like the person who I'm talking to and meet them where they're at.
Yeah, that's a piece of it is sort of the aesthetic of looking like a professional. Yeah, I guess there's a bunch of different parts. I haven't thought about it too much. By the way, Eric Olson is part of our Sonoma County Permaculture Professionals. In one way, he's really a keystone player because we meet at his Permaculture Skills Center. And he's facilitating a lot of the meetings, and he's really a great example of how to do permaculture professionally. So, yeah, so one part is being impeccable with your word, and, you know, your word is your bond, and you really stick to your word. One part is really doing high-quality work and getting the training and experience necessary to do really high-quality work and to present yourself in a professional manner, to know when you are qualified enough to really do a job. I think there's a lot of people starting out in permaculture who are super enthusiastic and they're like, yeah, we could do this. I took a weekend class in food forest design, so we could totally put in a food forest for you. And realizing, wow, like there's a lot of knowledge involved. And you know, you want to be really honest with your clients as much as you can in terms of your experience. And there's a time and a place to sort of push, you know, the edge and say, hey, we haven't done this before, but we have reasonable confidence that it's really going to work out. And here's everything I know about it, and this is why I think it'll work.
One of the things that I go through, and this seems to be a cycle for folks who go through from a PDC, you start out very enthusiastic but a little bit naive, and I don't say naive in a derogatory way for people who go through this, but it is. It's a matter of knowing what you don't know, in a way, and that a lot of times coming out of that, depending on what you've discussed, all the techniques become the focus. Because they're the bright, shiny things that are examples of what the principles and strategies can lead to. But it's that stepping back and being able to say, well, every site is different, so you may want to install a food forest, but you can't just take a food forest that someone else has designed and put it into a place. What I'm designing and installing in my backyard won't necessarily work 30 miles from here because of the climate change, let alone if someone in Sonoma County copied that and tried to install it there.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things that is, what shall I say, it's a drawback, but it's also, you know, just a reality we have to work with, is that a lot of these permaculture ideas are in their infancy. I mean, it's true, you know, there was a food forest planted in England, what was it, 30 or 40 years ago. But the idea of really gilding plants together doesn't have a lot of background in scientific investigation, and we are experimenting with it. And we learn so much as we're going through. Eric Tonsmeyer is a great example of the food forest he put in his backyard. You know, he would do it so differently if he had to do it over again another time. So we have to be honest with our clients in that regard. Like, hey, this is a new field, and we're doing the best we can in terms of making it a fully functional system that requires as little human input as possible. And fortunately, at the moment, there aren't a lot of places where people's lives really depend on it being perfect. You know, it's not like an elevator that if it fails, there's very massive consequences. But we really try to get the experience that we need to do something well, or to bring in collaborators and say, hey, there's a client who's really interested in, let's say, this Berman Basin rain garden project. I don't have a lot of experience in that, but my friend does. I'm going to bring him in, pay him as a subcontractor, and we both get work out of it, and I learn something about rain gardens in the process.
And because of the society that we live in, we ensure that everyone involved gets paid in some way.
Yeah, because we all pretty much have to pay rent or mortgage somehow, and so you got to be real with the money side of the equation. And you know, that's actually a really important part of the Sonoma County Permaculture Professionals Group. Is one of the main reasons I started it was because I wanted to make more income with my business. And, you know, I want to have a family. My wife and I are considering adopting a child, and the income I was making with my own business wasn't sufficient for that. And I've learned quite a bit in the meantime that's really been helpful along those lines. But a lot of people referred work to each other, which is really helpful financially. And we were able to do work that we couldn't otherwise do because we bring in, you know, professionals who have that outside experience. And we just learn how to run our businesses more efficiently. So we have to take up less time with admin work, and we get to spend more time sort of doing the billable hours. It's so funny. I sound like a businessman now. It reminds me of this quote from the founder of Patagonia, whose name I am blanking on at the moment. It's Yvon Chouinard. Yvon Chouinard, the founder of Patagonia. He said, you know, when I say that I've been a business owner for whatever it is, 40 years now, he says, you know, it's so hard for me to say that. It's sort of like somebody saying that they're an alcoholic, or, you know, like they're a lawyer or something like that. It's just hilarious because I came from a background in environmental education with super idealism and taking care of the earth and all that. And I've gotten to the point where I realized, oh, we need to run good businesses both to take care of ourselves and for permaculture to really succeed in the world. We've got to know all those things that maybe we don't want to know about running a good business in order to support the good work that we're doing.
It's funny to me because I had several businesses that failed before I got to the point where even though I'm in the black, I'm earning a profit from the work that I'm doing, even on a donation basis versus my inputs. My capability to do this is honestly because it is subsidized, because my wife wants me to do this while I'm in school and she's provides the primary income. But we're seeing a point where my income makes a difference in our family's budget. So, you know, that's nice. And I feel that I'm reaching that kind of financial success with this. But it's where I'm at now from where I was even just 3 years ago when I started the podcast and walked down this road and as I define my role in the permaculture community and as a professional more and more, I'm finding that I'm making a lot more of those entrepreneurial decisions. And they're becoming easier in ways that I couldn't have imagined them before because I was raised to get a degree and go work for somebody else. So I was never instilled with those entrepreneurial ideas. But now that I have them, I have friends who are about halfway to the point where I am, not necessarily in time, but in realizations of the things that you need to do to be a successful entrepreneur. And having the conversations with them now, I'm like, we need to sit down and talk because I'd like to help kind of get you to where I am. Because I don't understand why you're lost where you are. And that's only because of how much my perspective has changed that I'm making those kinds of decisions as a business person. And it's such a different point when you reach that place.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of a metaphor that I've heard people use sometimes. So often people running their own business are just sort of flying alone. And if we sort of imitate geese, sort of a natural, in permaculture, we're always imitating natural patterns. If we imitate geese and we realize that as a permaculture community, we're heading in the same direction, if we fly in formation, it takes so much less energy. It really cuts down on the drag. And the Sonoma County Permaculture Professionals is designed intentionally on a very simple concept. We come together one time a month, which is pretty doable for a lot of people. We have a potluck, and the potluck is important because people bond when they're eating. There's social bonds that happen in that context. And we talk about our businesses. And it's very intuitive. You know, people coming together and eating and talking about what they do. And it's really powerful to make connections with each other people and to find out where folks are at and how we can be helpful to them and how they can be helpful to us. And so I really encourage people who are out there who are doing permaculture, trying to do it for money, get together with other people who are doing that in your area as much as possible and start something like that. And, you know, whatever form it is, you got to design it for yourself. But something that really helps people so that you're not constantly recreating the wheel, because that's not really beneficial for anyone.
We're doing something similar in my area with some of the professional permaculture practitioners. And the way that we've been doing our meetings is when someone's working on a project, kind of the call goes out and whoever can make it that day goes over, helps pitch in a hand working on a project so that we all learn some new skills and have a conversation around it about what we're experiencing as professionals.
Great. That's fantastic. And really sort of getting that on-the-ground experience. I actually haven't seen a lot of projects of the other folks that are in the meetings because we're always meeting at night and just sort of focusing on the business end of things. But that's wonderful to be able to actually be on the ground and see the work that people are doing.
So since you got this group running, what are some suggestions you would have for someone who wants to build this kind of an organization?
Well, a couple of things. One thing is, I'd say regularity is really helpful. So we meet on the second Tuesday of every month, because that doesn't conflict with any holidays. So we can do that 12 months out of the year. Everybody knows, oh, it's the second Tuesday. No problem. We meet at a consistent place. So we're meeting at, we got super, super lucky that Eric Olson's Permaculture Skills Center just opened when we started meeting. So people know where to come every time to be with the group. What else is really helpful? You know, we have a Google group. I guess it's like a Yahoo group. I'm not that technically savvy. But that really helps us send out announcements for the meeting so people know, have reminders about meetings. And also people can ask each other questions like, can somebody tell me about workers' comp insurance? I don't have a clue. Or, hey, can somebody tell me who a good arborist is? I need an arborist. And so to have that as a, sort of a backup, like the community is really a bricks and mortar, flesh and blood community, but it's supported by an electronic community when people need sort of that instant contact and blast out to the group as a whole. So those things have been really helpful. What else? Just making sure that people have an opportunity to really connect and bond with each other and get to know each other to some extent on a personal level. So it's not just about business, but like there's a sense of, oh, I want to come back to the meeting because these are my friends, not just, oh, because these are, you know, people who are going to help me out. It makes it enjoyable and rich. So it's something that people really look forward to doing and going in there and catching up on what's going on in people's lives a little bit.
And I imagine that as that develops and you get a level of depth with one another, that that provides an opportunity for more trust and more candor, that you can be more open about some of the things that are going on with yourself and your business and finding solutions for it.
I think that's absolutely right. I'm actually in a men's group, and one of the things that is extraordinary about our group, we've been meeting mostly with the same guys for about 5 years. We've gotten to know each other so well that when one of us has a big problem, you know, falls down, fails in some commitment or other, we're able to give that man feedback in a way that is really caring, really straightforward, and actually helpful for who they are as a person. And my hope is that in the long run with this permaculture professionals meetings, we get to know each other well enough that we can say, hey, I know that you're really having a difficult time with this particular thing. And we can really sort of be honest and helpful in a way that would say, you know, the truth is you're not really good at marketing. I think it would be really helpful if you get somebody who's helpful in marketing because I think that's what your business particularly needs. Because goodness knows, we can't generally do everything in our business and really be successful because there's things we do well and there's other things that we don't do well.
I think of the work that I do and the time requirements to be kind of my own nanocorp and be doing everything. means that the things that I really want to do really well, I can't devote the same amount of time to that I would like in order to handle these other things.
And it's difficult, you know, being a small business owner and saying, oh, well, I'm going to pay somebody to come and do my books when I hardly have, you know, money to pay my rent. You know, those are challenging choices to make. But we can talk to other people who've made them and hopefully get some wisdom.
And a lot of times I find that it's just simple little, I don't want to say tricks that people do, but, you know, that kind of thing where it's, here's a shortcut that I found that makes this process easier. Oh, if you're not using a spreadsheet to track who's been paying you or what work you've been doing, that's a real easy way to start bringing these things together. Are you using a calendar of any kind?
Exactly. Yeah, there's all sorts of things. And sort of to pull out a little bit and look at the broader picture again. Like, we want to run our business as well so that we can, you know, pay the rent, pay the mortgage, food and whatnot. And also we want to run our business as well because as permaculturists, the work that we do is crucial to the world. You know, it really is. I really believe that very deeply, that permaculture is doing permaculture on a really big scale, high quality level has the potential to dramatically shift the earth in a good direction. And if we run our businesses with integrity and quality and wisdom and knowledge, then we can have more positive impact in the world. So I really encourage the permaculturists out there to learn more business skills so that you can have a better, deeper, more powerful impact in the world as a whole.
I think that's a really great place to bring us back around, and it moves us towards the end. From everything that I had written down for our notes for this episode, we've covered them fairly clearly from my perspective. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to this conversation with the listeners before we bring things to a close?
Let's see. You know, I feel like I've generally covered the bases. You know, again, I would just say for folks who are just coming into permaculture to really try to find a niche to operate in and to try to find mentors, I guess that's really an important piece, is to look for mentors. That, you know, this is not necessarily a paid relationship, but somebody who can sort of help you out and bring you up in the ranks. And to really think about doing high quality work that we do out there in the world. Yeah, I think that's about it. Oh, and I guess, you know, to tie in one other thing too, to realize that, like, what you're doing, Scott, is there's so many different potential niches. And I want to see more permaculture bankers. I'm so excited you had on the guy from the Permaculture Credit Union. I want to see permaculture lawyers, and I want to see permaculture doctors. What does that look like? You know, this philosophy can really integrate into probably just about any profession in terms of how we're relating with other people and relating to the earth. So I really encourage people to find their particular niche in that broader picture.
Well, I look forward to sharing your message and that thought with the world. Thank you, Damien, for taking this time to sit down with me in the middle of your day and have this conversation. I really appreciate it, and thank you for your time.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me on, Scott.
And that was Damien. Before getting to my notes, if you're interested in finding out more about the certifications offered by the International Society of Arboriculturists, I've included a link to that in the show notes, as well as to additional information on the tools and equipment mentioned in the interview. I enjoyed this conversation with Damien because of the mix between the technical and the professional, how in both sides we touched on rules of thumb and techniques for accomplishing good things in our practices, whether as an amateur or paid permaculturist. One of my big takeaways from this is about being a professional. We covered some of these core thoughts in this conversation, which were reflections of the interview with Dave Jackie. Three of the important pieces of functioning as a professional for me were not knowing what we don't know, forming a professional group, and working with collaborators. That piece about not knowing what we don't know sticks out because of the hurdles I'm encountering as the podcast and my role in the permaculture community continues to grow. There are licensing requirements, taxes to be accounted for, insurances to carry, and a host of other pieces of the puzzle that aren't immediately clear when starting this kind of work. Only as I bump up against them do I recognize them, which requires me to be reactive rather than proactive about responding to them. Depending on what kind of work you've done, you've probably encountered those days where something comes up you have to deal with that completely takes the wind out of your progress. You stumble to a halt and kind of have to reassess exactly where you are in order to move forward again. That's what this is like for me at the moment. I'm not stumbling into my issues so much as hitting them head on without even knowing they're there. And that's where I find that developing your own professional group is important. Even if you form this with fellow students from a PDC, it's likely that you'll each reach different milestones and obstacles at different times along your way, and you can share those discoveries with your group, so hopefully you can learn from the wisdom of one another and not all have to work through the same issues. You can also share notes on who your accountant, banker, lawyer, or insurance agent is. That's where we need to collaborate with others. We only have 60 minutes in an hour, 24 hours a day, 7 days in a week, and so on. And unless you've found a way to suspend time or go without sleep, both of which are things that I'd want to hear about, then there's only so much you can fit into your schedule. I know that even as I get rid of more and more of the extraneous activities in my life in order to focus on those things that really matter to me, there's only so much that I as one person can do. Working with others can free you to focus on what it is you do best. Or if there's something that you need help with, having them in can serve as a learning experience. There are many different ways that we can work with people around us, both volunteers, friends, family, people who are professionals that we hire, in order to make a difference in the road that we're on. Which brings us to the long portion of this update. First, thank you to everyone who responded to my recent questions on Facebook, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast. You help me build a better show so that together we can design and build a better world. It's also nice to know that I'm doing a good job at meeting your needs for a permaculture podcast. Second, I've officially made it to the point where the show needs to grow beyond this current stage, and that means enlisting the help of others to handle the tasks that, as I said above, I'm not good at. I'm working with a number of professionals behind the scenes to make that happen, but the pains that come with it are more than I imagined, but in the end I know that it's worth the investment. For those of you who are small business owners, I'm sure you can understand and appreciate the work that goes into growing and maintaining your business. Part of this expansion effort for the podcast is that I'm working with a local systems administrator to move the show to a new hosting service. That should vastly improve the response time for the website and your download speeds. I'm planning to get things set up and make that transition near the end of the year. I'll let you know what dates we expect downtime to get everything moved and set up. As part of that process, I'm also looking to redesign the website, though I'm still searching for a good web developer. With that new space, I'll be able to host more content, including videos, and grow the online PDC program so that they can be offered more frequently. This process includes getting an audio interface that will support up to 8 microphones, the necessary supplies to go with it like mics and cables and things, as well as professional recording and editing software, and a modern workstation to go with it. So I can produce all that audio, video, and other material into an ever higher quality final product in less time, allowing me to create more of these shows and release them more often. To support that, I've looked at the model that Jack Spirko uses for the Survival Podcast, and as a result I'm seeking sponsors for the show and also looking to offer supporting memberships. Regarding the memberships, in the couple of days since my thoughts on that idea took off, I've already secured a 20% discount towards a 1-year subscription to a permaculture magazine. A prominent permaculture author is including a collection of their past articles in the membership package. I'm personally offering a discount to members towards the online courses I offered during their membership period, and I'm working with some groups to offer transcripts of past interviews for the members. Transcription is neither cheap or easy, so I've picked 5 interviews based on listener feedback that will be the first to go through this process. And those include Radical Possibilities with Ethan Hughes, the 2 Natural Building interviews with Bob Tice, and the Carbon Farming series with Connor Stedman. Eventually, I would like to see all the interviews available as transcripts. From there, now that I'm getting versed in video production, there will also be exclusive videos for the members. And of course, that's not everything. And I'm already in touch with publishers as well as other permaculture teachers and organizations who have agreed to lend a hand. Those individual details are still being worked out, and I'll share more on those as this develops. And that brings me to the questions that I'd like your feedback on. Number 1, what are some products and companies you believe fit with the permaculture ethos, and you would like to see sponsor the podcast? You can contact me by email or phone to share those ideas with me, or if you're someone listening who would like to sponsor the show, contact me and we can discuss what the sponsorships look like. 2, To support all these pieces, what do you feel is a fair price for a yearly listener membership based on the initial benefits that I've already listed and the understanding that these benefits would continue to grow and change and you'd have access to them throughout your year of membership? I'm just trying to figure out what is an appropriate rate or knowing how many of you listen to the show and what I'm trying to accomplish. Number 3, what past interviews would you like available as a transcript for members? I kind of want to put a list together and do them in order as necessary until I reach a point where I can fill in all of the back catalog. Number 4, with this new host, I'd like to offer another option for a permaculture forum. Would you be interested in taking part in that? I'm looking for administrators, moderators, or anyone else who would just like to share the word of permaculture by joining and adding to that community. Last, with all this, is the online PDCs I'm planning for next year. Though the inaugural class has shrunk since we began, overall the course is rolling along nicely and we're learning a lot from each other. And thank you to my current students for being a part of this. If you're interested in joining one of the future classes, I'm planning 3 for next year. 2 of those will be the year-long PDC Plus programs, which includes personal mentoring and instruction. The first of those I'm planning to run from January 1st, 2014 to December 31st, 2014. The second will run from July 1st, 2014 to June 30th, 2015. The third PDC I'm looking at is a 3-month online intensive, running from probably August 2014 to the end of October 2014, focusing on a practical, project-based approach to the core 72-hour certification class. This will not include the broader discussions or mentoring that are part of the PDC Plus. They will be ultimately 2 distinct programs. Registration for those courses opens soon. You can email me or call me if you would like to know more, or if you'd like me to go ahead and send you a registration link before this opens to the public. Last, in this big update, I've been contacted about an opportunity for a PDC graduate, permaculture family, or small permaculture group. There's someone outside of Utica, New York, who has a farmhouse and land available for rent that they would like designed and developed by a permaculture practitioner. The property includes a 1,600-square-foot, 3-bedroom farmhouse with a wood stove, stone fireplace, and wraparound porch. Additionally, there is an 800-square-foot horse barn with 7 stalls that can be set up for other livestock or used for storage, and 2 300-square-foot storage sheds. The owner of the property lives on an adjoining farm and has field equipment that you could possibly borrow in order to implement your designs as the tenant. All of that is included for a price of $1,100 a month. The amount of land for use depends on what your needs are and in arrangement with the owner, but can include 5 to 15 acres of pasture, an additional 5 tillable acres, and a 10-acre woodlot. The owner and I spoke about this, and there's a lot of possibility that can go on with this site and the opportunity, but all that depends on what you would like to do and if it fits with the long-term perspective of the owner. And so that'll come down to individual negotiations. But one part of that is that if you do decide to take part in this opportunity, there is a potential for you to remain there long-term, possibly purchasing a section of the property as your own building lot. But again, that's an individual discussion you have to take up with the owner. If you would like to learn more, please contact me, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or by phone, 717-827-6266. And I can speak with you further about this opportunity or any other ideas, and also pass your contact information along to the owner of this rental opportunity. From here, next week on November 12th, Dr. Dennis Van Engelsdorp, a research scientist and the former acting state apiarist of Pennsylvania, who happens to be one of the first people brought in to investigate colony collapse disorder, joins me to talk about CCD, bees, beekeeping, the continued bee die-off, and what we can do to make a difference in the lives of our pollinators. After that is part 1 of an interview that I'm doing with Mark Lakeman. We talk in the first section about permaculture, personal empowerment, and just doing what needs to be done. On November 26th, Ethan Hughes returns to talk more about his life and the work of the Possibility Alliance. We geared that more towards an on-the-ground discussion of what it's like being and working there, but of course we also delved into some of the philosophical. Finally, for those of you who have been waiting for this interview since I mentioned it months ago, my conversation with Jack Spearco of the Survival Podcast will come out on December 3rd. All along the way, I'll be filling in those interviews with short topical shows and other pieces of interest. With that, we wrap this episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other. And of course, that little bit of legal that I include in here, the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann is released under Creative Commons Attribution, No Derivatives, Non-Commercial License. Feel free to share it however you like. Just tell people where you got it from, and don't change or sell it.